Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Jennifer Law, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Welcome to Venus Rising. I'm really excited about our guest today, Julie Bindle, who I've known for several years now. And I don't even really know which hat you wear the most, Julie, but you are an activist. You are a radical feminist. You're a campaigner. You're an author and a journalist. You write books and as well as lots of great pieces in the popular press. And along with your partner, Harriet Wistrich, you are the co-founder of Justice for Women. You spend so much of your time fighting for women, advocating for women in the space of violence against women, prostitution, pornography, and of course, our world's collided with the surrogacy issue. So welcome to Venus Rising, Julie.
Thank you, and it's a real pleasure to be talking to you today, Jennifer, as ever.
Yeah, I'm so glad that technology allows us to communicate this way. And you know, so far we've got 30, 35 countries listening in, so the word is getting out, which is great. But let's start with how do you describe yourself? I mean, do you see yourself more as a radical feminist, or an author journalist, or campaigner?
Well, that's a difficult question, but I've been a feminist campaigning to end male violence towards women and girls since I was 17 years old, and I'm 57 now. And that is such a part of my identity. I couldn't possibly separate it from who I am. It gets me up in the morning. It keeps me going. It's provided my community of friends, of colleagues. We've, met together, all of us across various different nations, on so many different issues that affect women and girls. But the primary way that I get my message out, and of course also earn a living, is journalism. Writing books, as many of your listeners will know, tend not to earn you very much money. It's more like a labor of love, but it does actually mean that you get to showcase your work and your views, which leads into, more gigs on US and UK based publications. So I became a journalist, not necessarily because I loved the media, but because as a campaigner, I had learned to work with journalists so that they got the story right, so that they stopped using the old mythology and tropes about victim blaming when they were reporting on sexual and domestic violence. And then I thought one day, I was stuck in the university doing research into violence against women, writing papers that probably about 12 people read. And then I thought, no, I want to actually talk to more people. I want to get the word out further than academia ever could.
Now, you said that you started this when you were 15 and
17.
17, sorry, 17. And was there some kind of flashpoint? Was there an event that happened? Or did you always sort of just grow up knowing that this was the space you wanted to work in?
There were a series of events. I grew up with two brothers, unreconstructed, working class father, very traditional, very loving, but very traditional, and a mom who'd had no opportunities because of her class background and lack of formal education. And I grew up in a town in the northeast of England, which is very conservative and often forgotten by our governments, quite poor, quite impoverished, and hard. Life was hard. And when I was sort of 13, 14, I remember thinking all the time, things are unfair. My brothers get to leave their clothes and their mess all over the house, and I'm the one that helps my mom before she comes in from work, tidying the house, putting my dad's dinner out, that kind of thing. Why is it that girls have this life that boys, boys have so much more freedom? And then just as it happened, at the time I was getting more curious, I saw a BBC, our national TV channel program, a series called Shoulder to Shoulder, which was about the British suffragettes in their fight for women's emancipation and the vote. And it just really fascinated me that those women could actually do something quite incredible with their lives because they were angry and they were determined. And then to fast forward on, during that time, there was a man called Peter Sutcliffe killing women in prostitution who were out on their own at night, who were vulnerable, killing women who just happened to go to the store at night for a packet of cigarettes or milk, preying on women because he was a sadistic necrophiliac. He enjoyed the act of killing and female suffering. So he was the kind of extreme end of misogyny that we see every day. And we were all terrified. The police botched up the investigation. They had no clue really how to find this man. He was killing all the way through the 70s. He killed 13 women and left 7 for dead by the time he was captured by accident by traffic cops at the beginning of 1980. And I had only been living in Leeds, a city in New Yorkshire, a couple of hundred miles away from my home, for a few months. And I happened to have met feminists there who were campaigning against not just the police botched investigation that meant that more women were being killed by this man, but also the press coverage, the media reporting, which suggested very, very clearly that the women that he killed who were not prostituted were innocent victims, but the women he killed who were prostituted or considered to be prostitutes because they were out drinking in pubs and dating men, as to be to blame, to be complicit in their own murders. And it was so extreme, the misogyny. And it was such a time in Britain where the stone had been lifted up by this series of events and underneath crawled out blatant woman-hating. That it was, I was in the right place at the right time, having met these feminists, having just moved to Leeds. And that was it. There was literally no looking back.
And did that set you off on more on a journalistic track to sort of document and write about what was happening? Or was it, did it more trigger the campaigning activism in you at first?
It triggered the campaigning activism because I was uneducated. I'd left school a year early. Nobody noticed. I went to a sink school, a really, really bad school. And, you know, really, I hadn't even learned basic grammar. You know, I was bright, but totally without any kind of skills that could get me into a job like reporting. So I did cash in hand work and I worked in stores and I basically spent my time doing feminist activism. But we had in those days, so by which time now, I'm talking about 1980 onwards, obviously it was well pre the internet. It was pre any kind of mobile phones, any of that technology. And we used to put out newsletters for other feminists to read when they went to conferences and meetings about women's liberation. And so we would literally type up these newsletters on old typewriters, and then we would copy them on, I can't even remember the name of these machines, but somebody listening will. You know, it wasn't anywhere near as advanced as a photocopier. Then we would staple these newsletters together and hand them out. And I started writing for these newsletters, but then drifted into different kinds of work. Eventually started doing research on violence against women because I knew how to talk to women. I knew how to document their experiences. I understood issues that they had been through and witnessed it or been through it myself previously. And as I say, it wasn't until later, in fact, 2004, when I formally left research to do journalism full time. But before that, I had written a series of op-eds when necessary, when I wanted to promote some aspects of feminist campaigning in the Guardian newspaper back in the 1990s. And that's when I realized that I could do journalism. And then I went on to do more investigative feature style reporting.
And you do it quite well.
Amazing. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So you said in your opening that, you know, your work is what gets you up in the morning. It's what, you know, gets you going. It gets you excited. What keeps you awake at night?
The same thing. So what keeps me awake at night is anger, to be honest, even more so than despair, because feminism is one of the most optimistic social movements on the planet. We have to be, because what we're trying to do is change the entire world population. So of the, 3.5 billion men, boys and men, males on the planet, we don't think that any one of those boys were born to be bad or to exert their power or supremacy over girls and women. And nor do we think that girls and women were born victims or good. Right? We firmly believe that power is the corrupting force here and that boys and men have been allowed to develop under patriarchy, to dominate women, not each man over each woman, but as a sex class. And so it's not despair that keeps me awake, because I know that things are changing, that although we take two steps back often before we take another one forward, we have accomplished huge, huge victories, especially in the violence against women world. But the anger that I feel at those public bodies, your president, my prime minister, our Crown Prosecution Service, your criminal justice system, as well as those systems all over the world, where they don't serve justice correctly when it comes to punishing the perpetrators of these crimes, rape, sexual assault, where they will rewrite atrocities that happen to women, such as prostitution or surrogacy or early marriage within some religious communities. And they'll just say that this is a choice or this is part of a culture. And that's what makes me very angry.
Yeah, I resonate with that as an activist campaigner. I hate the injustices. So let's talk about Justice for Women that you and Harriet co-founded how many years ago now?
It was in 1991, and we were aware of women that had been imprisoned for responding to male violence, for killing their violent husbands. And there were various campaigns run by other groups. And we were contacted by a woman called Sarah Thornton, who had killed her violent former police officer husband after he threatened to kill her and her child. He'd beaten her repeatedly. The usual story, I'm afraid. And she was given a life sentence for his murder. Nobody really understood that she was in a desperate state. This was not a cold-blooded revenge killing. This was a woman pushed to the edge. And of course, these offences are very, very rare. We're far more likely, way more likely to hear about men killing women after years of domestic violence. Whereas the women who kill, like Sarah Thornton, they've been at the receiving end of the domestic violence. They're defending themselves or acting out of desperation. And so we wanted to look not just at the issue of women who kill in these circumstances, because they're relatively rare. But we wanted to be able to compare these cases with men who kill, and I know this happens in the US as well, everywhere in fact, where men kill women who they're married to or in relationships with, and they use a defense of, well, she nagged me, she provoked me, she was unfaithful to me. And often judges will show more sympathy to that man than they would the woman who was fighting for her life. And that's why we set up Justice Women. And it's still going very, very strong today. And unfortunately, it still needs to be going strong.
Yeah. And for the sake of our listeners, you actually just provide the legal representation for these women and take their cases. And of course, these women have no financial resources. So that's a great public service that you offer to them.
They do. And we have no resources either. We've never had any funding. We've never had any grants. We run purely on a voluntary basis. We all have day jobs, as they say. And we've chosen actually never to become a charity, a registered charity, or apply for funding, because the crux of our work is campaigning and public awareness. And I don't know about your rules, but our rules for setting up a charity and being given charitable status here is that you can't be political campaigners. You have to provide some kind of service, some kind of support, or you have to be a kind of educational tool. So we have lawyers in the group that give their time for free if it goes to court and the judge allows the women who've been badly served by previous lawyers, and the judge allows them to shift to a different legal representative, in other words, one of our lawyers, then they will eventually get paid by the court. But we work on the basis that we won't ever get paid. We mainly put the word out there, my journalism, public meetings, all kinds of strategies that we have to really upskill lawyers in how they should be dealing with these cases by showing them, setting them an example of the way that our lawyers do that. And in fact, what your listeners might recall, a case from last year that was reported very, very widely, and a quick Google would show you all the detail of Sally Challen, who had been imprisoned for killing her husband, who hadn't necessarily been physically violent, although there had been some sexual violence, certainly. But it was coercive control. And this phrase now, coercive control, has become popular in ways in which we describe the way that some men do not use their fists to intimidate women and to keep them in line, that they put them through psychological hell. And what was really interesting about Sally Challen and her campaign is that her son, David, became a great, great campaigner on her behalf. And he's now one of the best pro-feminist men doing this work to stop other men from going down that route than pretty much anyone I've met in all of my years.
And he's very active on Twitter. I follow him. It's C-H-A-L-E-N, is that correct, David Challen?
C-H-A-L-L-E-N. That's right, David. And he's just the best. He's the best of men. He truly is a great role model. And he doesn't expect cookies for doing this work. He doesn't expect praise or thanks. What he's saying to other men is, come on, you know, we are the problem. So we need to be the solution. And, you know, he's a very, very bright man who saw the connections. He didn't just want to fight for his own mum. He could have just fought for his own mum and then hung up his anti-feminist credentials at the end of that when we got her out of prison and said, okay, so that's that now. Oh, but no, not David. Please follow him on Twitter, anyone listening, and see what great work he's doing.
Well, and they have to follow you on Twitter as well. And just for our listeners, we will put a link in to the Justice for Women website too, so that we encourage always our listeners to chip in, because, you know, if everybody chips in, you know, we all can raise some money to help Julie and Harriet in particular in this space for women who desperately need justice. So I'm grateful for your work. So let's talk about some of your books. What's your favorite book, the book that you loved writing the most?
Oh, well, I think anyone has to be an idiot if they enjoy writing a book. I mean, seriously, I would get them some serious psychological support.
But I mean, the most important book. How about that?
Well, you know, I've got a really important book that has unfortunately had to be on the back burner for a while, but that is very much in my mind, and that's a book about surrogacy and why surrogacy, including altruistic surrogacy, is harmful to women and harmful per se. But that's not yet written. The most important book I've written so far, and one that took 2 or 3 years of my life, is The Pimping of Prostitution, which is on the global sex trade, which crosses over significantly with the surrogacy trade, as you know, Jennifer. And that came out towards the end of 2017. And it is basically an investigation into the way that so many people and organizations have been hoodwinked into believing that prostitution is sex work and that you can regulate it like any other work. And, you know, we're hearing this argument now used increasingly about surrogacy. So I think that one of the most important things we as feminists and as social justice campaigners can do is to join the dots between all of these abuses of women and girls, because they really are all connected.
Yeah, and I love when you describe yourself as a feminist and not the fun kind. I think that, I mean, we all on the inside know what you're saying, but for our novel listeners, when you say I'm a feminist but not the fun kind, what do you mean?
You know, in the past decade or two, what's been happening, I think, with mainstream feminism is that young women in particular have been fed a lie, and it's a really pernicious lie, that the work of older feminists, of second wave feminists, as they call us, has been done. We are cancelled. We are no longer relevant. What we fought for back in the 70s and 80s, largely on violence against women, which unfortunately is still a global pandemic today, but that work is now irrelevant. And feminism is all about choice. It's all about personal choice. So it's about, you know, wearing lipstick is now a feminist activity. Having a big white wedding is a feminist activity. Incidentally, I've nothing against either of those activities, but just don't call it feminism. And even more worryingly, sex work is a feminist act because it's about women taking control of their bodies, taking control of their sexuality, when in fact it's anything but. And you hear the same about surrogacy. So young women saying, hey, you know, if I like being pregnant and I want to do this, why shouldn't I? Who are you to tell me what to do with my body? So it's become a neoliberal, individualistic concept for these young women, where they honestly think that Beyoncé is feminist because she's a strong, mouthy woman. Well, I love strong, mouthy women, but not all of them are feminists. So the fun kind are the ones that the men like. Now, many of your male listeners will be thinking, okay, she's going to start men bashing. I'm really not. I don't need to, because we know I'm white, and I know that I'm a problem if I don't recognize my privilege. and address the racism that might come from my mouth, and certainly the racism that I hear elsewhere. That's all we're saying, that, you know, some groups of us have privilege over others. But if men really like and applaud a particular type of feminism, by which I mean young men, the peers of these young individualistic women, then we're doing something wrong, right? If they're standing on the sidewalk, shouting and whooping and applauding slut marches, women walking down the highway wearing a bikini top or nothing, covering her breasts with lipstick across her chest spelling out slut. And if men are loving that, we need to ask ourselves, is that the most effective kind of feminism, where men don't feel challenged at all, where men don't feel uncomfortable at being called out? Because it's just playing to their needs. And I call it feminism for men. That absolutely is a feminism for men. So that's the fun kind, the ones that men can whoop and clap and be joyous about. The type of feminism that I do, we have lots of fun. Trust me, we have to. You know that. Yeah. You're that kind of feminist. But we are serious about the issues. We don't consider it to be about individual women's right to be sex workers or strippers. We don't say we'll stop those women. We have no right and no power. What we say is, this is not feminism. Lives are at stake here. And if we're really serious about changing the world, we need to count the dead bodies of women in the morgues. Yeah. We need to actually look at the end game, because male violence kills.
You know, and what really, you know, just frustrates me to no end in my particular work in the egg trafficking, egg poaching and surrogacy space, how many women throw women under the bus, how many women are willing to exploit another woman's body. And I just sometimes think, God, if we could just all be on the same team and not throw each other under the bus, so much of our work would be done for us.
And I think, I don't know what you think about this, Jennifer, but I think that there are increasing numbers of women who are becoming handmaidens to these men who are abusing and exploiting. So the pimps and the brothel owners and the strip club entrepreneurs, and they're defending those men, and they're defending their quote unquote right and choice to be exploited. And at the same time, thankfully, there are swathes of young women rising up and saying, we're sick of hearing from men with beards and blue fringes that sex work is work. We don't believe that stripping is empowering. And no, actually, we don't want to be told by you young woke men, what feminism is, when we are being sent dick pics on a daily basis. And we are literally being abused by pornography, which men are testing out on women, you know, having become porn sick and viewing 12 hours of it every day. So young women are rising up, but at the same time, there's a whole swathe of young women who are somehow convincing themselves that they'll be protected and that their lives will be easier if they go along with what these woke men say. Well, I'm here to tell you, sisters, really, you're not. The only way you can be safe and protected is to fight against this endemic. It's a pandemic. Mm-hmm. It is a global pandemic of sexual violence, because we all know that it's the one thing that bonds women and girls, is the fear and the reality of it. Nothing else bonds us, but the abuse that we suffer as women, that really is not an inevitability, not at all.
Yeah, and you know, we're actually recording this interview during the global coronavirus, COVID-19 pandemic, and I've probably read way too many news articles this week about the concern of the COVID virus as it relates to scare quote sex work. And I just want to scream.
Yeah, well, in fact, I just read something a couple of hours before we had this talk about how to keep women safe during sex work. Well, with or without COVID, you cannot keep women safe in prostitution. It is inherently unsafe. Now, I've been to a number of legal brothels and met with women there. Legal brothels are supposed to be the gold standard, the safest way to do quote unquote sex work. And the women all tell me that the men beg them for sex without a condom. And this is in the light of HIV being on the rise again recently, and other STIs being on the rise. So they really will take those risks. These men will take those risks. Now, I personally feel if they're going to take those risks, put themselves at risk. They deserve nothing. But they're putting the women at risk. And the women, of course, will then be carriers. And if they're lucky enough to see their children, which many women in prostitution are not, then their children will be at risk. So these Johns, you know, they really, really are beyond irresponsible and abusive. And the only way to keep women safe that are in prostitution right now is to shut down all the brothels, arrest the Johns, and give the women enough to live on for her and her children, and throw the kitchen sink at providing exit services for those women, because they want to get out of prostitution. I don't care what the pro-sex work lobby say, they want out.
That's so true. So our time is coming to a close here. What are you hopeful about? What do you see in the next, 3 to 5 years where we might see some real important changes and progress in this space for women?
Well, if we look at prostitution, it's grim. We have a huge global sex trade and a lot of people are getting very, very rich off it, and not the women. And it's the same with the surrogacy trade. A lot of the exploiters are earning huge amounts of money whilst the women are being used and abused and put in danger physically. And as we know, their mental health is at great risk. But I see some great opportunities here. First, to make stronger connections between forms of commercial exploitation of women. Surrogacy is one, of course. Selling milk from poor Cambodian women who have no choice is another. Literally taking the milk out of their babies' mouths for rich consumers. And looking at the whole range of abuses that women and girls are facing but are rising up against. And what I see with the work you're doing, Jennifer, is that you're bringing the voices of survivors closer to the ears of the general public and also closer to the legislators. And this is what the movement is built on, the testimony of the women who've been through these horrors, who may have justified it at the time, but who came out of the other end and say, that's enough. And they want to help other women. Laws can be put in place to outlaw surrogacy, to outlaw men's use of women in prostitution, to outlaw the exploitation in developing countries, such as the selling of breast milk. And we need to just continue to develop, I suppose, an even stronger two-prong attack. Public education and awareness and campaigning on the one hand, and legislation that deals with the perpetrators effectively on the other.
Yeah. And, we have interviewed, we haven't aired it yet, but Melissa Farley, and I know you and I both admire Melissa and her important work in actually doing the science and the research, so that we don't just have the stories of the women survivors, but we also have the data that shows how harmful this is.
Oh, completely. That data and that research is absolutely crucial. And, as an investigative journalist, on the ground reporting, where you can actually tell stories based on fact, based on reality, not just some idiotic commentary about how surrogacy is so great that there's just this happy, smiling baby at the end of it. But I think that what will ultimately change people's minds is the women's voices on top of the scientific, evidence-based research, where they are saying, yes, of course I was happy to do it at the time. Yes, of course I justified it at the time. But now I want to speak the truth. The women's movement is built on women recognizing our own collective experiences. And that's what's happening right now.
Well, this has given us lots to think on. And I'm always hopeful for the future. It's how we get out of bed every day and keep doing this, that there's one woman you can make a difference in her life. And you take the victories where you can, and the hits on your chin whenever they come. And you just dust yourself off and get right back up and start doing it again.
And we're a movement, so we can look out for each other. We're not doing this alone.
That's right. And we have to bring these younger women along, because I'm getting old, so.
Oh, me too. But listen, there's plenty more coming up there, but we'll be carried out in boxes. We won't retire. But even so, we need some fresh blood here.
So we'll put some links in the description of the podcast when we air it, so people can find you on Twitter and they can find Justice for Women.
Great.
And your book. But thank you so much for taking time out of your day to speak with us.
It's my pleasure, really. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.